Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Also with us is Annie Stupik, who is managing New York's Freshwater Mussel Program and is currently developing conservation projects as outlined in New York State's wildlife grant. You want to be a part of the conversation today? Maybe there's a critter in your backyard that's terrifying you and you want to know what it is? Give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Even if you're not scared, you can call. And you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik and your wildlife questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. I love it when we discuss wildlife on this program, and we welcome back today Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He facilitates the research, outreach, management planning for New York's big game, small game, fur-bearing wildlife. He has been a wildlife biologist in the DEC since 2005. Spent the first 17 years of his career coordinating management programs for white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose. Also with us today is Annie Stupik. Annie started as an invertebrate biologist in DEC's Wildlife Diversity Section last year. She's responsible for managing New York's Freshwater Mussel Program and is currently developing conservation projects as outlined in New York State's wildlife grant. Prior to her current role, Annie researched moose and winter ticks in Maine, assisted with big game management in New York, worked on small mammal and various other things in Wyoming, and served in the Peace Corps. Number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, welcome back. How are you, man?
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Having a good autumn and early winter?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's fun. Boy, the snow's coming down, huh?
I love it.
It's great. Annie Stupik, you're new here.
Yes.
Just relax. The show will be over before you know it. It's going to be fine. Tell us about this whole mussel program bit. I know nothing of mussels.
Okay, so you know what, like a clam or a marine clam or a marine mussel,
yeah,
right? So those exist in freshwater.
Right.
Which kind of blew my mind when I learned about it. So we have them here in New York. We have like 44 species.
You're not talking about zebra mussels.
No, those are invasive. Those are bad. Zebra and quagga are bad.
Right.
And they kill our native freshwater mussels.
Ah, okay, so let's learn more about freshwater mussels. Yeah, I knew nothing about this.
All right, so they, just like birds, right, just like we have 700-odd birds in the United States, there's maybe 300 species of mussels, I think, freshwater native mussels in the United States. And they, there's a whole bunch of different, they have different habitat requirements, right? Just like some birds live in spruce trees and some birds live in grasslands.
Yeah.
Different kinds of mussels live in different kinds of water habitats, aquatic habitats. So some are in ponds, some are in lakes. Most of them are in streams and rivers of varying sizes. They prefer, you know, one species will like silty areas, one species will like more sort of cobble or stone areas in the bottom of the stream. And yeah, they're very important in the ecosystem.
And so what do you do to manage this?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Well, briefly, you know, not the whole show, but a couple of minutes.
So, I mean, so right now there's a whole lot of unknowns. There's a lot we don't know about mussels. We know they're really important, the freshwater mussels, for the ecosystem, for maintaining healthy water. And so a couple of my projects now, we're looking for really rare species that we know they're federally endangered and we're not sure if we still have them in the state of New York. And then one of my other big projects that I'm working on is developing this whole slew of baseline surveys to really get an idea of what mussels we have in sort of the eastern and southeastern part of New York.
All right. And without belaboring it, we already have calls and emails coming in. But how do you do a baseline survey? Are you just grabbing a whole bunch of what's at the bottom of a river or a stream and then checking it out and then throwing it back in?
Kind of. Preferably, that's disturbing to the mussels by pulling them up. So what we prefer is sort of snorkeling or scuba diving along the bottom and looking. I don't get to do that. I get to spend my whole day at a desk, really. But I get to organize the plans for people doing that, which is almost as fun.
Do people, I mean, I've never even heard of such a thing. Do people eat freshwater mussels? Can they be eaten?
You can. Certainly indigenous peoples did. It's not recommended. First off, it's illegal to do that in New York.
Then we can't. Okay, fine.
You can't. It's also would not. They wouldn't taste good, and they're filter feeders, so you wouldn't want to eat something that's filtering maybe some bad stuff out of the water. So.
All right, let's just drop the whole subject, and we'll go to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst is here, and Annie Stupik from the New York DEC. If you have a wildlife question, we will let's grab a couple emails, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. This one is from Tara in Sharon, Connecticut. In the northwest corner of Connecticut, we recently saw a single dark brown doe with the oddest-looking face. It looked like a cow snout or a moose nose. Definitely not a normal narrow deer nose. At first, we wondered maybe it was injured and swollen, but it turned and looked at us for a good while. Looked like it was formed that way. All right, Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting story, and there could be a couple of different explanations. One, honestly, it could have been a moose cow.
Really?
Because there are
moose. In northwest
Connecticut, yeah. But likely it wasn't. They're much larger, and I would suspect that the average person would be able to distinguish that from a doe deer. However, deer sometimes can have a condition that we call, ironically, bullwinkle nose. Because they have a swollen rostrum, or their nose gets large and inflamed, and actually starts to appear like the form of a moose.
So this is from heavy drinking, I presume?
Presumably.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'm not positive as the cause of it. But anyhow, it can create that widened and elongated nose like that looks more typical of a moose, but on a deer.
That's amazing. Now, Annie, very quickly, you worked in Maine researching moose.
I did.
I go to Maine almost every summer. I don't think we've even seen a moose once.
You can ask me where to go to find the moose.
Where should I go to find a moose?
Oh, man. Baxter. In the summertime, they're in the water, right? So you want to go to, you've been to Baxter State Park?
No.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to go. The Northwoods is where you want to go.
So you want to go, I want to go further north.
You want to
go
up, and you want to drive the logging roads up in the Northwoods of Maine. Yeah.
But you don't want to get too close, right? They'll do some serious damage.
Correct. It's advisable not to get too close.
Do they get aggressive?
Yeah,
a cow with a calf would. And a bull during the rut might.
What's
be
a rut? I mean, so I've been in a rut for a couple of decades, but what's your rut mean?
So the rut is the breeding period in the fall. So for moose, that's usually September, and so that's when their antlers are large. They're going to be looking for mates, and it'd be the wrong time to get too close to a bull.
Okay, this is from Peter in Northern New Jersey. It's about a snake. Either of you good with snakes? Yeah. Yeah, no. Okay, well, I'll ask it anyway. Last December, just around this time of year, I was walking my dog by a lake. The temperature was 37 degrees, but there was no snow on the ground. The pooch stopped to sniff out something by the edge of the water and was startled enough to jump backward. I looked to see what the cause of the excitement was, and I was surprised to see a snake. Given the temperature, I thought it was dead or in a torpor, but when I poked it with a stick, it came to life and slithered into the water. It was a fairly large snake and not all logy. Is it normal for a snake to be out and about in such weather? What type of snake might it have been?
There's a lot of questions there, and yeah. I'm not sure I can answer all of them. However, I can say I had a very similar experience one time when I found a snake underneath the ice, actually, and was surprised in the same way to see it active at that time. And so I think it's probably one that's just been displaced temporarily and is going to go back to either find its den or burrow into the...
It went into the water, though, they said.
It did, yeah. In my case, it was underneath the ice, too, in a stream.
You know,
but we have some pretty cool snake biologists in our office who could answer this question in a flash.
But they're not here, alas.
They are not here.
We'll move on, then. Porcupine at SPAC Park from Mike. About 3 years ago, over the winter at the Saratoga State Park, which I visit regularly in the winter, I saw not one, but two porcupines in the trees pretty much all winter long. In the years since, I've never seen them again. Do you think they are there, or did they move on? What do you think? That's from Mike in Saratoga.
Well, I saw a porcupine. I saw a whole bunch of sign of porcupine in the woods once in the wintertime, and I was like, oh, man, what was here? And I didn't know, so I put my trail cam up, and that porcupine lived in that one little, I don't know, 10 by 10 square feet, clearly for the whole winter. I had like hundreds of photos on it. So I don't know. Maybe they just really hang out in the wintertime in
one
spot, right?
It's not uncommon to have porcupines that will just be in one hemlock tree for the year and they'll walk around feeding on
the branches. They live in trees.
They will sleep in trees and then come down and feed and such. And they'll chew around the bark of trees for some food. They'll eat the needles of the tree as well. They may maybe go in and make a den in a rock cavity somewhere, or just sit on the branch of the tree. So in this case, you know, Mike's asking about what happened to these porcupines. And of course, we can't say, who knows what happened to these two porcupines. They may have just moved on to another tree that he's not seeing, or, you know, they may have been killed for some reason and there is not a porcupine immediately in that visible space. There's not been anything that we're aware of that would affect porcupines broadly that he should be concerned about.
And there were a lot of porcupines around. I don't know if I think I've seen one dead one on the road maybe a couple of years ago, but I don't think I ever saw a live one around here.
Yeah, they're around.
Okay. One more email, then we'll take a break, then we'll hit the phones. We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik of the New York State DEC. It's Wildlife Today, 800-348-2551. This is from Everett. I found two nutria. Is that a thing? Nutria?
It is in the South.
Okay. I found two nutria in my pond this spring. Have there been many sightings of this animal? I live in Columbia County, about a mile from the Hudson River.
More than likely, what he found was a muskrat. They're pretty similar in size and shape. Nutria are an animal that's present in southern states, but not in the north, to my knowledge.
All right, let's take a quick break here. It's all about wildlife biology today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's get a little down, get a little funky. We'll be back. Brother Jack McDuff here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. That's the guy who was playing the music. I'm Ray Graff. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik today from the New York State DEC. The number is 800-348-2551. Okay, let's go to Orange County, and we'll go to Mike. Mike, you're on. Hello? Hello, Mike. Hey, Mike, how you doing, buddy? Well, I shouldn't hang up on Mike. Should I put him on hold, Zach? Mike obviously fell asleep during our scintillating conversation. All right, so let's see if I can figure this out. Mike, we're putting you on hold, and you're in timeout. Let's go to Marlborough, Vermont, and Mary, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. Oh, I'm so happy. I didn't know who to ask this question of. It's kind of a little off the wall.
Okay.
Here goes. Right. I live in the woods, far from the madding crowd, as it were. And I have cats, and I've been using this, they call it world's finest or world's best or something, this for a while, the litter, which is made out of corn. And the wonderful thing about it is, unlike, say, clay, I could throw it out in the woods far away from the house and the leaf litter, and it would just decompose. And I did notice that one day that there was a fox, looks like it was enjoying flavored corn bits out there.
Delicious.
And what looked like a big pile of, it looked too big for deer, but it was either deer or moose, and looked like there had been some corn there that was gone. Which didn't occur to me until yesterday. I wonder if they put clumping stuff. There must be some kind of mineral talc or something there. So when they make the pellets and grind them, they're wonderful clumping. But I'm wondering if that's going to be dangerous to the animals that eat it. If maybe I was thinking this was a natural way to recycle the corn, but now I'm wondering if I'm actually putting them in some kind of discomfort or risk.
Okay, we got about 70% of that, and we'll hand it over to our experts in a moment. But let me just ask you a question. Will the cat go in the corn? I've never heard such a thing. Will the cat use it?
It looks exactly like it looks exactly like kitty litter. In fact, the very first years and years ago I had it,
I had
a cat who, when it was fresh, he wanted to eat it. And then it did not do good for his digestive system, that's for sure.
Ouch.
But no, it looks exactly, and it doesn't have any odor or anything. I don't like the perfume stuff. It works, and it clumps great. And when you put it out, unlike the clay, which is going to be a slimy glob forever, it gets, decomposes like leaf litter, presumably. It's just cellulose, after all.
All right, so why don't we throw this over to Jeremy and Annie and see what you think?
It's a good question, Mary.
So much, because I wasn't sure who to ask.
Well, I'm not sure who to ask either. Really, I'm not. I don't know that I have a good answer for you as to whether this is safe or not, because I suspect there's a couple factors. One could be any health issues that the cat would be depositing into the litter that then would be exposed to the wild animals, right? So right. That's one. And then two, the...
Well, these are indoor cats. These are cats that have never been outside my house.
So okay.
I'm not too worried about that, but I am worried about whether or not it's going to be have a bad effect on animals that might eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, Mary, if you are worried about that, I know that they make, I don't know if you've seen the wood cat litter or the newspaper cat litter, but maybe that's less appetizing than corn would be, maybe, to wildlife.
And the concern I would have with the corn is not the corn itself, but whatever else is added to it.
The bacteria and worms.
Potential bacteria or worms that the cat might have, but also whatever additives are part of the litter mixed with the corn that could be problematic for the wildlife.
That's exactly.
Okay.
That was exactly my question, the additives.
All right.
It does clump. And it's a very, I'm not sure I'm at this point ready to transfer them, but I just thought, it just never occurred to me to think, of course, they're putting something in it to make it clump. And then,
I think Annie's suggestion is a good one.
Annie's on the case here. Yeah.
Okay.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. It's Pets and Vets all of a sudden here on Vox Pop. And we're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik. It's wildlife today. That was an outlier. Are you having fun so far, Annie?
Yeah, lots. I'm not a cat litter expert, but I can. I tried.
I got to be honest. We've never really had a cat litter question on this particular show. So there, on the Pets and Vets, we have it all the time,
sure.
But not this. Let's go to Andy, who's in Northwest Connecticut. Hello, Andy in Northwest Connecticut.
Hi, glad to be here. So I heard Annie is a expert on freshwater mussels. So this isn't really a question, but I have an interesting story.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
I live on a brook, and it's called a brook, but it's like 40, 50 feet across of running water. And during Hurricane Irene about 10 years ago, my riverbank got destroyed, so I had to have it rebuilt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had to go through a whole bunch of permitting, and I found out that I have an endangered species in the brook, the eastern pearl shell mussel. Apparently, there's only a few habitats of these left in the world. They're because they're a mother of pearl shell, they were used to make shirt buttons, and that's how the species got destroyed and why they're now endangered. So I learned they're the longest lived bivalve of any. They live to be 100 years old. They're quite large. They're 3 inches long. So I had to hire a marine biologist to relocate the whole
the mussel bed?
The whole bed, yes.
Yeah.
The whole bed of them had to be relocated. He moved 100 of them. He super glued little numbers on every single one.
Yep.
Came back a year later to see how many survived. He moved 100 of them. He found 75, and they were all still alive.
Oh, that's great.
But who knew? There were these big, quite large mussels living in a freshwater brook way up in Northwest Connecticut.
Oh, that's
they're pretty incredible. So eastern pearl shell this is going to sound dorky, but they're kind of my favorite species of freshwater mussel so far.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
why?
Thanks for the story.
Thanks, Andy. Why are they your favorite?
Well, they live a really long time. Like, they can even live 150 years, but they're also different from most of our other freshwater mussel species in that they really like mountain streams. Like, they're sort of, most mussels like rivers and sort of siltier areas. And these guys are the ones that you'll find like in the Catskills, Adirondacks, where we do have mussels in the few streams. They like the cold mountain brooks.
Now, are you all right with this person super gluing numbers onto the shells?
Sounds like they hired someone to do it. So yeah, that's, you tag mussels. That's how you go back and you check to see how many survived and if they're still there. And yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Let's go back to our phones at 800-348-2551. Mike in Orange County. We went to Mike early, and Mike wasn't ready. Now, I'm going to you now, so turn your radio down, and I'm ready? 3, 2, 1. Mike, you're on.
Okay. I was ready before. I could hear you, but obviously you couldn't hear me.
That's
we good
correct.
Now?
Yeah, we're good. Go ahead.
Okay, great. This is for Annie. I'm aware of 3 or 4 places here in Orange County that have mussels. They're black, 2 to 3 inches long, and they actually look like saltwater mussels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what species they are. I didn't know there was that many species in New York.
Yeah, so it's species identification is a tricky thing. So these are live ones that you've seen or just shell specimens?
Yeah, no, they're alive, yes.
They're alive. Because, yeah, sometimes people find shell specimens in the water and say, oh, what is this? And it's somebody's lunch that they chucked into the water.
Right.
But, yeah, if they're live ones, there's it could be a whole bunch of different species. There's about 25 or so different species that could be down there. And they can be really hard to identify. Oh. But if you want to, you could send in some, take some photos and send them to our wildlife inbox.
Okay, you might as well tell us how people can do that.
So preferably you take photos with some kind of scale. So you could even put one on your hand or, preferably you don't take them out of the water.
Right.
So, but yeah, if you see one on the bank, then you can sort of put your finger next to it and take a photograph of it and submit it to, what is the inbox?
wildlife@dec.ny.gov.
Yeah. And if you send that along, Mike, then I can, that'll be forwarded to me eventually and I can, get you some identification on that, hopefully.
Okay, great. Can I ask you one more question or tell you something and a question?
All right. Go ahead.
Ray's call, not mine.
Yeah. About 15 years ago, up in Sullivan County on the Delaware, I found what I know was a hellbender. And I called the DEC in New Paltz, New York, and they told me there was no hellbenders in the Delaware River. They are only in the Susquehanna in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So now I know what I've seen, and it was a breeding of breeding size. It was probably 14 inches long. And now I've heard that they have DNA to check streams and rivers. Now, I know why they wouldn't put it in the public that they are there, you know, and I'm not going to say why, but
okay.
Have they?
Hang on.
Probably they're there, though.
All right. So hang on, Mike. What in blue blazes is a hellbender? Tell me.
Oh, hellbenders are awesome. They're they're salamanders.
Oh.
They're big. They're big salamanders.
Yeah.
Like if I show you a picture of this thing, you're like, that exists here?
Really?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So what do you think about what Mike says?
So very likely we just didn't have information to know on their distribution at the time. He's right that we knew that they were in the Susquehanna drainage. They're also in the Allegheny drainage in western New York.
So it's in that neck of the woods.
Well, you know, the Delaware is further east than that. And so it may be that just they weren't aware that they were present at that place. And what he's talking about DNA is now we're using more specialized techniques where you can actually take a water sample and look at that sample and test all the different types of species that might be present. You can scan that sample against all sorts of types of different known DNA samples
right.
to see what animals are present.
That's and how so, we'll find Bigfoot eventually, right?
Well, we need a reference sample.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
point. That's the hard part.
Mike, that was very interesting. Thanks for the call. Speaking of very interesting, let's go to our buddy Merle in Argyle. Hello, Merle. You're on.
I'm on. Good. How are you guys doing?
Good? Pretty good. You know, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
All right.
First off, it's going to sound bad, but you keep saying Ann stupid.
Stupid.
It's stupid
like.
With a K instead of a D.
That's
Merle.
A terrible thing to say, Merle. Let's restart the conversation. Now, bring something good to the table.
Everybody.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Muscle. Since you brought that up, or you're there, how are they for cleaning one plastic and two? That PC or you know that
PCBs,
P all those
the bad water and
PFOA and whatnot. All right, so
yeah.
I mean plastics. I would say that would kill them if they were to consume microplastics. Filter that out from the water. I would say that would kill them pretty quick.
Okay.
Yeah, that is the thing that some people discuss is, well, can we use freshwater mussels, put them in water, and then will they clean our water for us? Because they are filter feeders, and they do that naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they will certainly take some PCBs up from the water and other those forever chemicals that you call them. It's not good for them, certainly, and it will over time. It affects their reproduction and their health and their survival. So, yeah, I mean, for the sake of the animals, that is not something because, you know, 2/3 of freshwater mussels are endangered and perilled to begin with. That's not something that we don't do that, right? We don't put
so
mussels in the water to kind of to kill them, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
What else
okay,
you got?
All right. The question I called for was, this is a general question.
All right.
What is better for the environment, a forest or grassland?
That's an interesting question, Merle.
Open grass.
All right. Jeremy's going to handle this one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like asking which one of your kids you like more, right?
Right.
You need them both. And
you can't say that on the air. So
don't answer that.
Don't go there.
But really, individual species have specific needs for their habitat. And some species thrive in grasslands that would do terrible in forests. Others do fantastic in forests and wouldn't do well in grasslands. And so when we look at the state of New York, we want to have a mix of habitat types that can really maximize and provide the optimal habitat for the variety of species that are present in the state. And so for us as biologists in New York, we want to see both healthy woodlands and healthy grasslands.
Merle, thanks a lot. It was good stuff. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop today, and it's biology with Annie Stupik, with a K, Merle, with a K, and Jeremy Hurst from the New York State DEC. 800-348-2551. Let's go to dear old Delmar. Sue, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My main question is, and I will explain why I'm asking it if you'd like, is do squirrels have organizational skills?
Okay. I love that. So why, Sue, why? Why are you asking this?
Okay. Some people who are, good with wildlife, they're people from the Cornell Cooperative Extension, and cleaning out a garage, discovered little pockets all over the place, and they would have either all Norway spruce pine cones or sumac or, hemlock cones. Each type was carefully categorized in one nest for each.
Wow.
And I am just blown away by this. And they thought it was squirrels. But have you ever heard of that?
I haven't, but it's a really wild observation. And
yeah.
And certainly, squirrels are known for hoarding seeds.
Yeah.
Right? That's not a surprise. I would suspect what's going on here is that these seeds are coming ripe and cones coming ripe at different times. And so likely that squirrel is capitalizing on a nearby tree that's just producing a lot of hemlock cones and a lot of spruce cones and a lot of sumac seeds and so on, because they're ripe at specific times. And
yeah.
At that time, it's going to cache them in its little place. But that's what's available at the moment. And so that's why they're all being organized.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yes, I was just blown away by the idea. But thank you so much. I will share the information.
Sue, thanks a lot. I love the idea of little squirrel accountants, just being able to have a little abacus. They check things out. Let's do one more call, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll do some emails, et cetera. Chris is in Brantford, Connecticut. Chris, you're on.
Hi, Annie, Jeremy, and Ray. Happy holidays.
And to you.
This is a question about catamounts or mountain lions. Living in Vermont for many, many years, my family had three sightings of them.
Uh-huh.
And even just before calling, I looked up the population, and the population is always zero. And why is that? I mean, what's the criteria for determining the population?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Usually we need to have animals present to have a population. And so what the challenge for mountain lions is that we have lots of reported sightings of mountain lions, but very little to zero evidence of mountain lions that are present. And so we used to not believe that there was likelihood of any mountain lions in the East. However, we were all kind of proven wrong about, 2011 or so? There was a mountain lion that came from South Dakota, moved through southern Canada, through northern New York, and was killed by a car in Connecticut. So the issue here is that animals can move a long ways. Very unlikely that they do and very infrequent that they do. But when they do move long distances like that, they leave evidence. And so in this particular case, that animal left evidence in every state and province that it passed through with visible tracks, DNA evidence, as well as camera images from such. And then, as we suspected, given the road density in the East, once it got to the East, it was killed by a car. And so states all across the Northeast deal with folks who believe they've seen a mountain lion. In fact, our staff often will go out and investigate situations where there seems to have been a credible sighting. And invariably, other than this one case, There have been maybe a couple released pets that were held illegally and released, but the overwhelming response is it was a misidentification of a house cat or a fisher or a coyote or a dog. And so we'll use cardboard cutouts or plywood cutouts of a life-size mountain lion, hold it in position, do the relative scale, and really demonstrate that what was seen was not.
All right, Chris, we got to take a break here. It's Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik from the New York DEC, and we'll be back with more of your calls and your emails. Oh, I love this one. Is it Danny Gatton, right, Zach? Yeah, let's hear it. Man, that guy left us way too soon. Danny Gatton on the Telecaster and Blues Newberg here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. You know, you guys must get sick of hearing people talk about, I saw a mountain lion. But it happens so often. Bobby writes in, hey, are there any in the Catskills? I swear I saw one. It looked like it was bigger than a bobcat, less long hair. Are bobcats, can they be easily mistaken?
Oh, for sure.
For mountain lions.
Yeah. And Bob, I should have mentioned bobcat and when I spoke earlier, because they are frequently misidentified as mountain lions. And the reason for that is their body shape, the way they walk, if you have a video of it. And sometimes, depending on the position, you can't see the tail. But, you know, we have reports. I think one of my favorites is a picture of a dragonfly that is taken by a trail camera. The dragonfly is off in the distance, and so it's small, it's brown, it's in the perfect position for it to be in a habitat as if it's walking through high grass. But if you zoom in, you can see the wings and you can see that it's clearly a dragonfly. But at the zoomed out position, it sure looks like there's
so
something
wild.
Else there.
I mean, you know, a forced perspective. You know, you're seeing something that's very small, very close.
Yeah, and I shouldn't be too dismissive because, you know, the reality is we have had a mountain lion come through the state. But we have to be realistic that it's highly improbable that we have mountain lions that come through. And when they do, they don't float on there. They leave lots of evidence.
Okay.
And that evidence is lacking.
Paul in Rhinebeck says, is it possible that a red fox has built a den under my overturned kayak in my backyard?
Sure.
They like it under porches and stuff?
Yeah.
Well, the one we have in our backyard comes from under a neighbor's porch. Well, I'll tell you what, the various cats in the neighborhood, they're well aware of this thing. They stay far away. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Let's go to Billy in Poughkeepsie. Billy, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Ray, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. We had a question for Annie. We heard a gentleman calling earlier about he had 100 mussels on the shore. They had to relocate them, number them, and he got to 75. It's a very limited population of 100 in an isolated area. So simple question. I feel like a kid. How do mussels make more mussels?
Oh.
All right. Now,
this gets me real excited.
Just simmer down and be as graphic as you like. Go ahead.
This is an awesome question, Billy. Okay. All right. So they're different by species, right? But most species of freshwater mussels we're talking about have distinct males and females. Some are hermaphroditic and can swap between sexes, but we won't get into those.
Okay.
So most of them, the males will put sperm into the water in the summertime or in the springtime, and the females will take that in through the water, their filter feeders, and so they just have a filter that filters food and other things. And then they'll fertilize their eggs. And then some of them will keep them all through spring and winter. And then others will wait until the following year. But what they do is they have this special adaptive lore, most of them. And so they have this, basically it's an appendage, like a limb that mimics a fish. And so, or some kind of tasty snacks. One of them has one that looks like a crayfish. And then the idea is a fish will come swimming along, see that and say, oh, that looks like a tasty snack. And it'll come down to take a bite. And then the female will release that. She'll release her babies. She'll release the fertilized eggs, which then attach to the gills of the fish. Yeah, as their parasitic larvae.
So it's all based on trickery and facades.
Yeah, and the evolution of these things is astonishing. If you look up like mussel lures, freshwater mussel lures, I mean, it looks like a fish, and they'll move them in the water like this.
Yeah.
And so the fish will come up, and it'll grab it, and then the female will release her eggs, her fertilized eggs, and then they'll attach to the gills of the fish. Usually they're harmless.
Right.
And then the fish will swim around, do its thing, and they drop off after a couple weeks or a couple months, and then they're baby mussels then, and then they go down into the substrate.
That is crazy talk. Billy, are you sorry you asked?
Sorry, Billy.
Billy's dumbfounded. Huh? Billy, you want to follow up? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I know the feeling. All right, Billy, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Ooh-wee. That was a weird one. Fred in Hancock, you're on.
Hello there. Happy holidays to
you
everyone.
Too.
I want to question about a gray creature. We live at the edge of the Pittsfield State Forest, and this large gray something or other I saw just from behind the first time. It was poised away from me, looking up, and it had some kind of prey, and it leapt as if like a fox would. It leapt with its face down to get whatever it was after. So then the next time we saw it, it was walking across our backyard, and it had a snout that resembled a cat, not a fox. And this thing is kind of battleship gray with a long fuzzy tail, and looked like a cat, except it was more the size of a bobcat than a cat.
Huh.
My wife checked with ChatGPT and said it's a Norwegian forest cat.
No way.
So that's how much we know.
Well, I suspect it's not a Norwegian forest
Why?
Cat, but, well, because we're in the United States and not Norway.
Well, they can swim.
It's a long swim.
All right.
However,
it's domestic,
Fred,
though. That's
oh, domestic.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So there's potential. It could be a domestic cat, and some domestic cats can be quite large. It could also be a fisher. Now, fisher tend to be much darker in color. And so it could be a fisher that has some pelage abnormality that is a little bit lighter. And some older fishers, they end up getting some grizzled color, a little bit more gray in color. So that's a possibility as well. Fisher are smaller than bobcats, but at distance it could be difficult to tell. And if you saw it pounce, it's probably, was it on snow or in leaf litter?
It was not snowing yet.
Okay. It's so not uncommon for...
On ground and tall grass.
Okay.
But crossing the road, crossing our dirt road, and quite visible.
Sure. Well, then I think probably what you're looking at is either a domestic cat that's roaming at large or potentially a fisher.
All right. Thanks a lot, Fred. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. That's the number. And let's see here. Well, all right, Annie Stu, pick a number. Whatever line you want. You go ahead. You tell me.
Oh, I don't know. Should we could do a muscle question number
all right.
three?
No, all right. Number three it is. And we'll go to line three. It's Carl's turn. Carl, you're on.
Good afternoon. Sorry to be so stuck on muscles, but...
Well, she's here.
What I'm here
talking
for.
About them, I wondered whether or not they would clean my... ponds. I have like one of these backyard ponds with some koi and comets, you know, little fish in it. And I'm distressed about what I think is animal or fish waste, you know, clogging up my filter. And I was thinking, geez, would mussels help?
Sure. It's a great question. We get it a lot. In a water body where there already is sort of a lot of waste and excessive algae maybe in the water, any mussel, freshwater mussel, a native one that you put in there is just going to die, to be honest. They're real sensitive to water quality.
Carl?
Oh, well.
Yeah. Sorry.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Buckland, Massachusetts. Pat, you're on.
Good morning. It's afternoon.
Good evening.
I live in the foothills of the Berkshires, eastern foothills, and I go kayaking on the Deerfield River in the summer. Not where it's rapid. It moves a little, and it's only about 2 feet deep or so. And there'll be a span of area probably, 20, 30 feet long, where we'll see intermittently bubbles coming up. Is that mussels?
I would suspect it could be, sure. If you see it coming from the very bottom of the substrate.
Because you can see to the bottom, and we can't see anything.
Yeah, and the Deerfield, it certainly could be.
They'd be in the silt, just like clams.
They're
in
the Deerfield River watershed. I think, there's three species that I know of that occur in that watershed.
Yeah, there's a huge area of them. Thank you. It's been a mystery. I've asked, and everybody said, I don't know.
Well, don't take my word for it. It could be a lot of things, but...
Okay. I mean, it might be.
What could it possibly be, though? I mean, it's not...
I mean, it could be fish with air bubbles, right? Or turtles, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we can see all the way to the bottom.
Okay.
Oh.
And you can't see anything but the silt. The water's clear enough. All you see is the bubbles coming up. There's no sign of an animal or anything.
Where is this? It's a pond? Or it's a...
This is in the Deerfield River.
Maybe there's Alka-Seltzer down there, you know?
There are mussels in that area, Pat, if that helps. So it could be. They're
okay,
not going to
they would be. They'd be in the silt.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. If you look real close, you can see their little. If you see a little tiny siphon opening in the silt, that's a mussel.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
All right, Pat. Thanks a lot. Let's go now to Tom in Amsterdam. Tom, you're on Vox Pop. Hit it.
Hey, good afternoon. My question is for Jeremy. I'm in Unit 4W, which has an antler point restriction for deer, and I want to know, is it working versus targeting does?
So what's Unit 4W?
So 4W is just one of our wildlife management units down in Delaware County.
Okay.
We have the state kind of subdivided into 92 different management units.
And gotcha.
So there's a handful in the Catskills that have a mandatory antler point restriction, which for listeners means that hunters, when they're harvesting antler deer, they're restricted from taking smaller deer. They can only shoot deer that have larger antlers.
Understood.
And part of the rationale for that was when it was first initiated, hunters were shooting a lot more younger deer, smaller antlers, and other hunters wanted to have opportunity to take deer with larger antlers. And by prohibiting hunters from shooting the small ones, they get older, they get larger antlers, and then they're available then. Some folks at the time thought that that type of change would shift hunter behavior towards harvesting antlerless deer. What we've learned through the process and from other studies is that really it didn't. Hunters aren't taking antlerless deer more because of that restriction. They're just shooting older bucks. And so in the sense you asked if it worked, it didn't work in terms of increasing antlerless harvest, but it did shift the age structure of the bucks that are being harvested and made the bucks that are being harvested slightly larger and slightly older. Now, I'll say we have a variety of, a handful of management units in the southeastern part of the state, essentially all the other units in the southeastern part of the state that don't have the mandatory restriction. And we've been encouraging hunters across the state and in that area as well to practice voluntary restraint. If they want to see older deer, larger antler deer, just to choose voluntarily not to shoot the small ones. And many have complied. And so, in fact, even in those areas where the mandatory program is not in effect, hunters now are taking considerably more older, larger antler deer than they ever did before, and many, many fewer yearling deer. And so it's the program has worked in the area it was implemented, but it's not really necessary everywhere else.
Tom.
But is it helping this with management, because you're still issuing DMP tags for does?
As I said, it doesn't have an impact on antlerless harvest. The hunters are taking male deer at the same rate they did before and not taking antlerless deer at any higher rate.
Tom, thank you very much. Let's go to Wappingers Falls. Peter, you're on.
Hi. I'm embarrassed to have this question. These questions have been so great, but I'm excited about the squirrel part of it. My daughter rescued about 32 of them. From down south and brought them to a group in Boston. But now she has a house in Cranston, Rhode Island, and it's got a lot of trees in the yard. And she works with a group in North Kingston that provides her with squirrels that they find that have fallen out of a nest, and they're like the size of mice. And my daughter rescues them, brings them to her house, and she's built this shed for them out in the backyard out of old tree branches, and got them wired in there in a doorway so that they're safe from predators. And she's raised, I mean, she's got five now.
Right.
And they, within a couple of months, grow really, really fast. I have photographs of my daughter with four or five squirrels climbing all over her shoulders and head.
Oh.
And then she can reach up with her hand, and I did this last week with a walnut in my fingers, and the squirrel will come down the tree with its claws, hold on to my hand to steady it, and eat the walnut out of my fingers.
Wow. Peter, is your last name Doolittle by any chance? Are you a doctor?
No, but you know me well. I usually refer yes. to myself as a troublemaker.
Right, yes. And I hope that this is all true, Peter. All right, Jeremy, we're almost out of time. Comment on this, if you will.
Yeah, Peter, I'm sure it's a fun experience for your daughter and you. In New York, it's required to have a wildlife rehabilitator license in order to do that activity. And so we're grateful that we have licensed wildlife rehabilitators in the state. When we have animals that are injured or orphaned, these rehabilitators do a great job of caring for them. Part of the motivation of having them licensed is because they need to have the training and the facilities to do it properly. And one of the key things that we're looking for is lack of habituation with humans. And so that means caring for the animals in the way that the animals could then be released back to the wild. And if we're training them to have relationship with people or be comfortable and familiar with people or relying on people for food, that's not going to make them so that they're releasable, that they're able to survive on their own. And so the wildlife rehabilitators do this in a professional and appropriate manner.
All right. Peter, thanks a lot. We're going to have to leave it there. We're about out of time. Got to tell you, we have so many emails here with mountain lion sightings.
Oh, I bet.
I mean, it's so why? I mean, usually, you know, the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. Could all these people be wrong?
Well, so potentially there's a mountain lion running through New York right now, right? If it came from South Dakota, that's a long walk for a young mountain lion.
Yeah.
But it's possible. Is it likely? Highly unlikely.
Yeah.
However, we like the idea of mountain lions. It would be awesome if we had mountain lions.
So you're not against it?
No, no.
You're not a hater.
But, so we like the idea, and we see things that we don't always got really good glimpses of, and our minds can go to what we want rather than maybe what is real. And so it's hard because some animal sightings are difficult.
Okay.
We'll take your pictures. We'll take your track pictures. We'll look at it.
Give that email again, would you?
Or wildlife@dec.ny.gov.
All right. Thank you both. Annie, what'd you think?
Pretty great.
Did you have fun?
So much fun.
So maybe you come back again. I mean, we do these things regularly.
And
it's really up to Jeremy. If he doesn't like you, you don't get back on.
He used to be my boss, you know.
Really?
So, yeah.
So he likes you somewhat.
I don't know about that.
Okay, fair enough.
She left to go to grad school.
Let's bring that up the next time. Support comes from Chesterwood, the Gilded Age estate of American Renaissance sculptor Daniel Chester French, decorated in style for the holidays, open touring of the residence and studio, holiday shop at Hot Cider, tickets at chesterwood.org. At Hudson Valley House Parts, Newburgh, an architectural salvage store, sourcing large-scale architectural antiques and vintage components for use by preservationists, architects, designers, and homeowners. Hudson Valley House Parts on Instagram. Thanks again to Jeremy Hurst and Annie Stupik of the New York State DEC for being here today. That was a good one today. Well done, everybody. Thanks for your calls. Sorry if we didn't get to your question via email. And the 97 people who have seen mountain lions, we'll do our best next time. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the phones. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. We welcome back our pal, Chef Rick Orlando. See you at 2:00.